This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. 1 year ago this month, the Catholic Church chose a new pope. Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio ushered in a surprising new era for the church, an era he introduced in choosing his papal name, one of his first acts as pontiff. He chose Francis in honor of the medieval Italian saint dedicated to humility and the poor.
And more change was to come. On Holy Thursday last year, Pope Francis washed the feet of 12 juvenile detainees, including two women and two Muslims. He took a selfie. He declared himself not a right winger. And he said that if someone is gay and searches for the Lord and has goodwill, quote, who am I to judge?
The sea change in tone and style has made Francis an astonishingly popular pope. But in the end, do the scales tip towards symbolism or substance? And what does Pope Francis's first year mean for the future of the Catholic Church, an institution itself not prone to radical and sudden change? Well, there may be no one better suited to explore these questions than John Allen. He's one of the world's foremost reporters on the Vatican. He lived in Rome for more than a dozen years reporting for the National Catholic Reporter, CNN, and NPR. He's author of many books on the Church, including the first English biography of Francis's predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI. And a former editor for Newsweek once said that, quote, Allen has become the journalist other reporters, and not a few cardinals, look to for the inside story on how all the Pope's men direct the world's largest church. John Allen is now an associate editor at the Boston Globe, and he joins us today from the studios of Colorado Public Radio in Denver. John Allen, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello, Meghna. It's so good to be with you.
It is a delight to have you. Thank you so much for joining us. And listeners, this is a pretty fantastic and rare opportunity to talk to one of the Vatican's most veteran watchers. So what do you think of Pope Francis's first year? Has he been a reformer? Have his actions matched his words? Do you like the direction that Francis is taking the Catholic Church? Or would you like to see more substance than style? What is your question for John Allen? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet if you'd like at Radio Boston. Now, John, I wonder if we could just start back right in those first hours and days when Cardinal Bergoglio, who was soon to become Francis, was named as the new pontiff. Can you just tell us what your first reaction was to that news?
Well, to be honest with you, Meghna, my first reaction was frustration because I was on a CNN set trying to tell this story to the world. And when the Cardinal Jean-Louis Touraine came out to do what we call the Habemus Papam announcement, that is the announcement of the new pope's name, we lost audio. So I saw the cardinal's lips moving, but I had no idea what name he was giving us. So for 30 seconds of agony, I was desperately trying to figure out who the next pope actually was.
Oh, wow.
Fortunately, there was a Mexican TV crew behind us that was shouting, Bergoglio, Bergoglio, so I had a clue. After that, to be honest with you, I was floored by the choice of name. Let's remember that the first decision any pope ever makes is what name he's going to be called by. I mean, the way this works inside the conclave is once a candidate crosses that magic two-thirds threshold, the senior cardinal will approach him and say to him, do you accept your election as the supreme pontiff? The moment he says yes, he's the pope.
Mm-hmm.
The next question is, by what name shall you be known? So it is, by definition, the first choice he ever makes. And I'll be honest with you, I have interviewed church historians over the years who had said there could never be a Pope Francis, for the same reasons there could never be a Pope Jesus or Pope Peter, that these were singular and unrepeatable figures in the life of the church. But more than that, to be honest, I was astonished at the boldness of it, because the name Francis is a whole program of governance in miniature, this iconic figure in the Catholic imagination that awakens these images of the antithesis of the institutional church, that
exactly.
is the charismatic leadership, close to the earth, close to the poor, simplicity and humility. That's an awful lot of weight to put on your shoulders right out of the gate.
Well, if I can
you're
just
not prepared to walk that talk, then you're going to be in real trouble. Francis, however, during his first year, has convincingly walked the talk.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but I just want to jump in here because it's funny that you say it's an act of boldness because it's embracing humility. I mean, that seems to be the balance that Francis, as Pope, has been trying to strike in this past year. But just to be clear, I mean, he is officially Pope Francis the first in the 800 years since the death of the man who was Saint Francis, right?
No. His title is Pope Francis. There cannot be a Francis I until there is a Francis II.
Got it. Okay. But he is, as you said, the first pope to take the name Francis.
That's correct.
Well, so you were floored at the beginning here. And was the rest of the world equally floored by this decision by the cardinals to elevate this man to be the next pope of the Catholic Church?
Well, I mean, it's not as if Jorge Mario Bergoglio was a completely unknown quantity. He had, in effect, been the runner-up in the conclave in 2005 that elected Benedict XVI. So I think insiders knew the book on him. They knew that during the 15 years he had been the Archbishop of Buenos Aires in Argentina, he had refused to take a chauffeur-driven limousine and had instead taken the bus to get around town. He had declined to live in the Archbishop's palace. He instead lived in a Spartan two-room apartment downtown. And Mechna, when I say Spartan, I'm not trading in euphemisms. It was the kind of place that he had to leave the stove on 24/7 over weekends during the winter because the building couldn't afford central heat. Everyone knew that he spent a great deal of his time in what the Argentinians call the vicias miserias, that is, the slums, these vast pockets of poverty that ring Buenos Aires. So I think insiders knew that about the man. I think the outside world, however, he was certainly not a celebrity. And so there was a journey of discovery. And I think in many ways, actually, that helped him. Because unlike his predecessor, Benedict XVI, who came into office with a prefabricated and somewhat unflattering narrative. I mean, he was, you know, God's Rottweiler and the Vatican's enforcer and so on. Pope Francis did not come into office with a narrative. He was able to shape it for himself, and I think with the benefit of hindsight, we would all say he's done it brilliantly.
Well, so that leads me to what I find to be one of the most interesting aspects of the first year of Francis's papacy, that perhaps Benedict XVI was, you know, he might have been a much more beloved pope 50 years ago or 100 years ago. He seemed to be a pope almost out of his time. But on the other hand, Francis seems so perfectly suited for not just the Catholic Church as it finds, you know, it's trying to find its footing in 2013 and 2014, but the world and what it wants as a pope.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think one of the striking things is not as if Pope Francis is the first pope who's ever been popular. I mean, I followed John Paul II all around the world. I was with him in Mexico when he had crowds around 7 million people. I was with him in Manila in the Philippines when he had 5 million. I was at his funeral mass in 2005 when 5 million more showed up. And Benedict, in his own way, in terms of the insider Catholic world, certainly has a following. I think what's unique about Francis is that, if anything, he is at least as popular and potentially even more popular outside the church rather than in it. I mean, he is a figure who seems ideally suited to engage with this postmodern secular world that no longer speaks religious language and has a hard time swallowing religious concepts. He uses a kind of language, and because of perceptions of his personal integrity, he carries a kind of moral authority that somehow allows him to transcend those boundaries and become a credible dialogue partner for the whole world.
And it's also, I think it's emphasized, and we'll talk more about this in a bit, in just sort of how he presents himself, you know, through his words and actions and even his physicality as Pope. And I remember there was, an urban legend that came out in the early weeks of his papacy that the first time he was asked to put on, what's it called, the mozzetta?
Mozzetta.
Mozzetta. Yeah. That's the cape of red velvet that the Pope typically wears. It was reported, widely reported, that Francis said the carnival is over, that he wasn't going to wear such a thing. Turns out he never said any such thing.
That's right.
But the fact that it seemed that the world embraced even just that turns out to be false attitude about what he was going to bring to the papacy, just it made me think that this was a world that was hungering for the type of humility, the type of down-to-earth face that Francis was putting on the papacy.
I think you're 100% right. I think you actually can learn a great deal about Pope Francis from the kind of urban myths that have grown up about him. I mean, another one that's more recent, of course, is this business about him going out at night in Rome incognito to give sandwiches to the homeless guys who live around St. Peter's Square. Now, the Pope recently said in an interview with an Italian newspaper he has no idea where that came from, and it never entered his mind to do it. But it's interesting, isn't it, that the world perceives it's the kind of thing Francis would do. Because that sort of personal, not only the simplicity of being able to, of being willing to go out, you know, without the papal regalia, but that special concern for the poor, that concern for the ordinary people who were in your neighborhood, that just resonates with people, and they're ready to believe that about Francis. To be honest with you, I'm skeptical that an urban myth like that might have grown up about other popes.
Well, John Allen, the one other best things about your longtime reporting at the Vatican is that you've been able to talk over many years to a lot of high-ranking members of the Catholic Church. And I'm curious, in the past year, what have they been saying? What have the cardinals been saying about the man they elected to the papacy? Did they get what they think they were going to get?
So you're asking me the buyer's remorse question.
Yeah.
Listen, my read would be, and this is based on conversations with probably a third of the 114, because there were 115 cardinals who voted in the conclave. One of them, of course, came out as pope, so that leaves 114. And I've probably spoken to a third of them since then. They'll tell you some things are exactly what they expected about Pope Francis. They knew he was a man of the poor and a man of deep personal humility. They knew he was a good governor, that is, a good business manager in Buenos Aires, and they've certainly seen that from him as pope. Other things have been more of a surprise. He had a reputation in Argentina as being something of a conservative, so some cardinals would be surprised at how moderate he's turned out to be as pope. And I think the other dimension that has floored everyone, and here I can quote Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York, who told me, we knew we were electing a man of the poor and a good governor. We had no idea we were electing a rock star. I think that dimension of Pope Francis has taken everyone by surprise. But to come to your question, are they feeling any regret? Basically, the answer is no. I mean, aside from their deep belief that the outcome of a conclave is shaped by the Holy Spirit, at a very practical level, Magda, it just makes their lives much easier to have a popular pope. You know, if they need a favor from a legislature right now, there's no politician in the world that wants to be on the wrong side of this pope. If they go on TV, the questions are no longer about pedophile priests or crackdowns on nuns. They're about, you know, the charismatic pope and how great he is. When they go into dioceses and they go into parishes, they go to the grassroots, in other words. People aren't angry. They're euphoric. And so at that level, I think the Francis effect has just improved the day-to-day quality of their lives to such an extent. I don't perceive many cardinals wanting to roll the clock back to March 12th, 2013.
Well, let me ask you, how big of a deal is this? Because obviously ever since 2002, especially after the, you know, sex abuse scandal broke, it seemed, and for, you know, many people would say for very good reasons, cardinals were incredibly beleaguered by the constant criticism that the church was getting about how it handled, you know, generations of allegations of pedophile priests. And as you were saying, all of a sudden, Cardinal Timothy Dolan is saying he's not really getting that many questions about it anymore.
Well, look, I mean, it's not as if those storylines have gone away. And obviously, just this past week, Pope Francis created a new commission, a pontifical commission for the protection of minors, to lead the fight to the cleanup operation, so to speak, from the church's sex abuse scandal. So, I mean, I think the pope himself is well aware that's still out there as something that has to be dealt with. But that said, I think the fundamental accomplishment of Francis's first year is that he has completely changed the narrative about the Catholic Church, whereas a year ago, when people outside the church thought about Catholicism, it was usually through a lens of suspicion related to the sex abuse crisis, related to the perception that this was a boys' club hostile to women, and any number of other things. Today, when the typical outsider looks at the Catholic Church, it's through a lens of sympathy because they find themselves beguiled and charmed by the new pope. And at least at the level of perceptions, if that's not a revolution in a very short arc of time, I'm not sure we've ever seen one.
Right. So, I mean, I didn't mean to imply at all that the issue of church sex abuse is gone, because it is certainly not. We're going to talk about a little bit more about that in a moment. But I guess what I was getting at is I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I did get a sense, especially under the papacy of Benedict XVI, that at times church leaders were saying that they, in a sense, felt victimized by modernity, by the constant criticism that the church was getting, regardless of what it did to attend to the sex abuse scandal, and that they felt, for lack of a better term, again victimized. But by becoming such a popular and beloved pope that we see in Francis now, has he eased some of that sense of victimization and defensiveness within the church? And perhaps could that be a prelude then to further change?
Well, on the sex abuse issue specifically, I think the evidence is mixed. You know, the Pope just gave an interview to the Italian paper Corriere della Sera, in which he was asked about the church's response to the sex abuse scandals, and he used some of that defensive rhetoric that you're talking about. You know, he said that, you know, no other institution has reacted with such transparency and commitment, and yet we're the only ones who are attacked. Which reminds you of the kinds of things that senior church officials were saying 10 years ago. But on the other hand, I think the big picture is that Francis has made it clear that he wants a church, to use his language, that gets out of the sacristy and into the streets. That is, it's not having a conversation among itself, but it's having a conversation with the wider world and taking seriously the criticisms and concerns the wider world has. And as that plays itself out, I think that's going to have a natural leavening in effect also on the willingness of the church to listen to its critics on the sex abuse scandals. And again, I think the appointments that Pope Francis made last week for this new commission, impaneling 8 people who have global reputations as reformers and not a single person who would be perceived in Catholic terms as a denier, I think that is a fairly clear signal that the Pope is starting to get it.
Mm. Now, let's just get straight to this question that we broached in the introduction to you here, John. Some of the Pope's most ardent supporters may be worried that this first year has been more about style than actual substance. Is that a fair criticism of Francis?
Well, it depends on how you define substance. I mean, if by substance you mean changing the doctrine of the Catholic Church, then it's a perfectly accurate criticism because the Pope has not changed a single comma in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which is its official code of teaching. And on the hot-button issues that tend to excite the Western mind, I mean, things like like women priests or abortion, gay marriage, contraception, he has made it repeatedly clear he's not going to be making any changes. But look, and I think the point is, you can change the Catholic Church profoundly without changing its official teaching. I think what Francis has done, 2 points primarily. One, he's created much more space for flexible pastoral application of doctrine, that is, translating that official teaching into practice at the retail level in parishes and so on. The other thing he's done is that he has pushed the church, kicking and screaming, in the direction of real structural change on matters such as transparency, accountability, and what you might call good governance. I mean, he just created an entirely new finance structure in the Vatican, appointed a tough-as-nails Australian cardinal to run the thing, who has the mind of a theologian and the instincts of a linebacker. I mean, this guy is basically Brian Urlacher in a cassock, okay? he's going to push through significant change. And all that may not have the sex appeal of inviting 3 homeless guys up to his breakfast, but I'll tell you, there is no way to break the grip of the old guard in the Vatican more thoroughly than by taking away their power of the purse, and in effect, that's what Francis has done. So if your definition of substance is changing church teaching, then no, there hasn't been substantive change. If you understand that there are a truckload of other ways to engineer structural change in the Catholic Church without changing teaching, then yes, this is a historically significant structural change agent.
Well, especially given the fact that the Vatican's financial dealings have been rife with controversy for many, many years. I mean, to say the least.
Which is to put it mildly.
Exactly. And if we only had several other hours to talk about just that issue. But listeners, we're talking to John Allen. He's associate editor at the Boston Globe. He's one of the world's foremost reporters on the Vatican. He's author of 9 books on the Catholic Church, including The Catholic Church, What Everyone Needs to Know, and Pope Benedict XVI, The Biography of Joseph Ratzinger. And we're talking about the first year of Pope Francis. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. John, let's take a quick call here. Peter is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Peter.
Yes, hello. I'm, I would dare say, as a oddly Episcopal believer, agnostic questioner, whatever, the Pope is absolutely my guy. I mean, in the sense that when I look over the life of Jesus in, say, first century Palestine, the Pope is doing exactly the sort of things that it is reported that Jesus did in terms of the poor, the Samaritan woman at the well, you know, the whole collection of things that you can find, you know, in the Gospels and the parables. And I think the best thing for me is that if we can give him and grant him patience and allow him to persevere and to persist in this direction. We will all be well served, and I wind up with a feeling of being really warm, welcome, worthy, and wanted, however I am by this man. And I would just love to buy him a dinner and ask him 100 questions. Mr. Obama, that opportunity.
Peter, you never know. Pope Francis may be the kind of guy that gets word of this and actually takes you up on your offer. But thank you so much for your call. John Allen, let me ask you, I mean, how important is the sentiment expressed by people like Peter about feeling a sense of love for Pope Francis? And not just like people like Peter. I mean, I've read a lot of your reporting that talks about how vastly important it is that, you know, Francis, by virtue of being from Argentina, can speak to Latin Americans, can speak authentically to the poor in Africa, that, you know, the two-thirds of the Catholic Church who live in the developing world.
Well, I mean, first of all, Mechtin, just to echo your point to Peter, I mean, I would not exactly say it is astronomically unlikely that by floating the idea somebody would like to get a phone call from Francis, they might actually get one. You know, I mean, he's earned a reputation in Italy as the cold call pope because he's constantly calling up people he's never met. In fact, the Italian version of Jon Stewart, the most famous nighttime comic in the country, did an essay in one of the main papers the other day, 10 etiquette tips for what to do when the Pope calls you up, because this thing happens so often. So it's entirely, and I'm actually kind of irritated because I'm the last guy I know who has not gotten a phone call from the Pope. But look, how important is it for the Pope to elicit this kind of feeling from people? It's phenomenally important, because let's think about what the job description of a pope is. I mean, first of all, he is supposed to be the evangelist in chief of the Catholic Church. That is, it's kind of chief missionary, the chief apostle, the one who sort of takes the message of God's love and the redemption of humanity to the street and makes it opens it up for the world. And when he is beloved and respected, obviously it's much easier for him to do that. The other thing, the Pope is also supposed to be a voice of conscience in human affairs, being able to stand up against war, to stand up in favor of the poor, to stand up in favor of environmental degradation, to stand up against abuse of immigrants. And obviously, when Francis does that, it is much more effective because people are inclined not only to listen to him, but to listen to him sympathetically. I mean, in effect, Francis is the new Nelson Mandela. He's that new tower figure of moral authority on the global stage, and when he says something, most people are willing to think, well, that means it's on the side of the angels.
Right. Well, but on the other hand, he's not universally, to the last person, adored. I mean, as we mentioned earlier,
well, no one ever is.
Right. But I mean, there's. I think that we should give voice to the significant pockets of criticism that have arisen. As we mentioned earlier, there are a lot of victims' advocates in the sex abuse crisis who would like to see Francis do even more in addressing that major issue head on. And also, you've reported that there's conservative discontent amongst Catholics. I mean, I'm looking at one of your pieces here, and you quoted an American Catholic pundit who called Francis a theological train wreck, and an Italian conservative who wrote that Francis's papacy is a road that leads to schism and heresy.
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, despite the fact that the guy's got 90% approval ratings in most parts of the world, I mean, that 10% pocket of discontent nevertheless is significant. You're quite right. I think, and it's not, by the way, you're right that there are advocates and victims of sexual abuse who would say that this pope profiles, in their views, basically as another cleric in denial, and they are looking for much more significant action for him, in particular, holding bishops accountable who fail to apply the church's official zero-tolerance policy. There are some conservatives who believe that this pope's shoot-from-the-hip style is a little too loosey-goosey and is sort of betraying the doctrinal heritage of the church. But let's be clear, there are also some liberals, who believe that the Catholic Church ought to ordain women as priests, that it ought to change its teaching on contraception, that it ought to change its teaching on homosexuality, who have now repeatedly heard Francis say he has no intention of doing any of that. I think in the long run, some of those people are going to be unhappy as well. But look, at the end of the day, one thing you dare never forget about Pope Francis is that beneath this humble, simple exterior lies the mind of an incredibly savvy and crafty Jesuit politician.
Uh-huh.
Okay, Jorge Mario Bergoglio knows what he's doing. He's been in leadership for 40 years, I mean, basically his entire adult life. He knows that opposition is out there, and I think over time he's going to do what he can to try to bring those folks along.
I want to get one more call in here. Lisa is calling from Framingham. You're on the air, Lisa.
Thank you so much. You actually addressed one of those issues. I'm a recovering Catholic, and among my social circle, many people are saying, oh, aren't you excited about this new pope? And I really feel that most Catholics of a certain generation are very suspicious. Until there are changes, and they won't happen in my lifetime, about women in the church, about homosexuality, about contraception. It's as if they live in a different world. American Catholics have used contraception for 40 years, even though the church has said no, no, no. So I'm a little less optimistic and a little suspicious of the sort of showiness and the and one question that you may answer, is it true that he hired the consulting firm McKinsey to help him with his entree into the world? And I'll end with that question. Thank you so much.
Lisa, thank you so much for your call. John Allen?
Yeah, that is true. I mean, actually, I'm not sure there's a major consulting firm left on Earth that doesn't have a Vatican contract now. McKinsey has been hired to advise the Vatican on restructuring its communications operations. Ernst & Young is advising the government of the Vatican City State on its business operations. There's another American consulting firm called Promontory that deals with regulatory compliance that is helping the Vatican Bank review its some 19,000 accounts. You know, this is all under the rubric, of course, of trying to collaborate with the secular world, trying to open the church up to outside expertise to be able to answer some of the questions that clerics were never trained to answer. So the intent is noble. However, I think there are many observers who would look at this proliferation of consulting firms and ask, is it possible there are too many cooks in the kitchen right now in terms of this Vatican reform project? You know, we're just going to have to wait and see.
Yeah. John, I've just got a minute to go, but I do want to ask you one more question that Lisa sort of got to. How long can the honeymoon last?
Well, listen, we're both media people. I mean, we know that narrative is all, and Francis right now has an extraordinarily positive narrative. My own suspicion is that if he doesn't do anything to upset the apple cart too dramatically, that narrative is going to have some legs.
Well, John Allen Jr. is associate editor at the Boston Globe. He is one of the world's foremost reporters on the Vatican, author of 9 books on the Catholic Church, joining us today from the studios of Colorado Public Radio in Denver. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you, John. We look forward to having you back on the show many times.
It was a treat. Anytime.
Thanks so much. And listeners, continue this conversation about your impressions of Pope Francis's first year in the office of the papacy. You can do that at radioboston.org. But stick with us, because coming up, we'll take a look at the dramatic political intrigue playing out in Rhode Island after the unexpected resignation of House Speaker Gordon Fox. I'm Megna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.